Welcome to The Bloody Bible, the podcast where we explore why our fascination with crime is as old as the Bible itself. I'm Kaz.
And I'm Em. And in this episode, we're going to be taking a closer look at a biblical woman whose name has become synonymous with evil, idolatry, and sexual immorality. Can you guess who it is, Kaz?
Well, I can think of a few female figures in the Bible who've had a lot of bad press over the years. There's Eve, Delilah, the Whore of Babylon. But then we've already discussed them in previous episodes, haven't we? So I'm going to go for Jezebel, because she's not really made much of an appearance in our podcast so far, and she does have a pretty bad reputation.
Spot on, Kaz. You got it.
Yay!
So, listeners might recall that we mentioned Jezebel very briefly in our Season 1 episode on biblical femme fatales, but I think she really deserves an episode of her own. Jezebel has probably one of the worst reputations among all the biblical women, and in fact, maybe even among all biblical characters, regardless of their gender. Whenever she appears, she stands accused of being a dangerous, duplicitous, murderous non-believer who uses her power to try and destroy the religious heart of biblical Israel.
Yeah, but despite all that, I really find her such a fascinating character, don't you?
Right? Yeah, I totally agree. So let's take a closer look at the text she appears in, and we can also think about the ways that Jezebel's reputation reflects a number of harmful stereotypes about women.
And as always, just a heads up for our listeners, we'll be touching on the topics of misogynistic violence, murder, racism, enslavement, and sexual violence. So if you find any of these topics particularly triggering, please take care as you listen to this episode. And of course, we will include links to some support services in our show notes. So Em, tell me, if we're looking for Jezebel in the Bible, where would we find her?
Yeah, good question. So Jezebel appears intermittently throughout 1 Kings chapters 16 to 21, and then she makes a final appearance in 2 Kings chapter 9. But the name Jezebel is also mentioned in the New Testament book of Revelation. You might recall we spoke about this in our episode on New Testament violence back in season 1.
Oh yeah, yep, I remember.
Now, we're going to focus primarily on Jezebel's character in 1 and 2 Kings, but at the end we'll come back to think about why her name was used in the book of Revelation and how that might have impacted her reputation across the centuries.
Sounds good. So what do we know about Jezebel from 1 and 2 Kings?
Well, it's interesting because despite the fact that she's so infamous, there's not a huge amount of detail about her in these Hebrew Bible texts. We're told that she's the daughter of Ethbaal, the Phoenician king of the Sidonians.
And where was Phoenicia?
Yeah, so Phoenicia was on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, which is the area that corresponds to modern-day Lebanon.
Okay.
Now, the text tells us that the Phoenician princess Jezebel becomes the wife of Ahab, the king of the northern territory of Israel. In 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 30, we're told that Ahab, quote, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all the other kings who came before him. And his evil doings seem to get even worse when he marries Jezebel. Kaz, can you read out verses 31 to 33 for us, please?
Sure. Not content to follow the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Ahab took as a wife Jezebel, daughter of King Ethbaal of the Phoenicians. And Ahab went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than had all the kings of Israel who went before him. Oh, okay, so Ahab really doesn't get a good write-up here, does he? But what's an Asherah, Em?
Yeah, so Asherah is the Hebrew name for Astarte, a Canaanite fertility goddess. Now, in English Bibles, the word Asherah is often translated as sacred pole, so it seems to refer to some sort of symbolic or sacred object representing the goddess.
Oh, okay. So it sounds as though Jezebel is being portrayed as a bad influence on her husband. Ahab married her and then he began to worship Baal and make Asherahs.
Yeah, that cause and effect link seems quite clear in the text. She's effectively being accused of undermining her husband's loyalty to Israel's God.
And do you think there's also a connection being made between her bad influence on Ahab and the fact that she's not an Israelite? I seem to remember other biblical texts that make connections between foreign women and idolatry.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There seems to be a biblical trend of blaming non-Israelite women for leading godly Israelite men astray. Just to give one example, in 1 Kings chapter 11, we read that Solomon's many foreign wives, quote, turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not true to the Lord his God. Apparently, Solomon began worshipping non-Israelite deities, and he even built altars for them so that he and his foreign wives could offer incense and sacrifice to these gods.
Okay, so non-Israelite women can sometimes be accused of having a dangerous influence on men, even powerful men like King Ahab and King Solomon.
Yeah, that's right.
And Jezebel's an outsider, a non-Israelite, and I'm guessing her loyalties lie with the gods and goddesses of her Phoenician culture, not with the God of Israel.
Mm.
But I'm wondering, why should she have to give up her own religious beliefs and practices just because she's married to Israel's king? And what if she just wants her husband to enjoy the spiritual benefits that she thinks her religion would offer him?
Sure, I can see your point. But as we read on, it doesn't seem as though Jezebel is content to practice her own faith alongside Israel's religion. Instead, it seems she's intent on stamping her own religious beliefs on this land she's now living in.
Okay.
So in 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 4, we're told that, quote, Jezebel was killing off the prophets of the Lord.
Oh, why was she doing that?
Presumably because they wouldn't serve her gods. Verse 19 reports that she has no fewer than 850 of her own prophets, 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah, eating at her table in the royal palace. And things have become so fraught that some of Israel's prophets are currently in hiding to prevent her from killing them.
Whoa, so she's really not holding back, is she?
She is not. She's not trying to win hearts and minds here. She's using brute force. Womanist biblical scholar Will Gaffney describes Jezebel as, quote, something of a fundamentalist. Her support of her own prophets on an industrial scale can be read as evangelical missionary work. Jezebel uses the considerable resources at her disposal to support the religious institutions of her people in her new land.
And does anyone in Israel try to stop Jezebel?
Yeah, they do. In 1 Kings chapter 18, we read that the Israelite prophet Elijah appears and demands an audience with King Ahab. Elijah accuses Ahab of having abandoned the Lord's commands by following non-Israelite deities. And then he says to Ahab, quote, now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table.
Ooh, so what's going on here?
Essentially, Elijah is challenging Jezebel and all her prophets to a competition up on Mount Carmel. We're told that everyone assembles on the mountain, then Elijah speaks to them. He says, get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves, and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God.
Ah, I see. So it's essentially a test to see whose deity is the most powerful, right?
Yes, exactly.
And it's interesting that only Baal is mentioned here rather than Baal and Asherah together.
Why do you think that's significant, Kez?
Well, it just makes me think that this is a bit of a manel, a showdown between male prophets and two male-identified deities. Jezebel's not even there, is she?
No, she's not.
Yeah, so Jezebel's not there. Asherah doesn't get a mention. All the prophets appear to be male, or at least female prophets aren't mentioned explicitly. Perhaps this is as much about stamping out female authority, both political and religious, as it is about demonstrating whose God is more powerful.
That's a really interesting point, yeah.
So what happens at this competition end? Don't leave me in suspense.
Well, predictably, Elijah wins the competition. The prophets of Baal go first, but despite their best efforts, the fire on the altar remains unlit. Then it's Elijah's turn, and he ups the ante by drenching the altar in water to make it even harder to ignite. But despite this, the God of Israel answers his prayers. Fire rains down from the sky and burns everything on the altar, the bull, the wood, the stones, and even the water.
Whoa, okay, so quite a display of strength from Israel's God.
It is, yeah.
And what happens to the prophets of Baal?
So we're told in verse 40 that, quote, Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there.
So in a sense, Elijah's emulating Jezebel here, isn't he?
Okay, in what way?
Well, they're both 100% convinced of the power of their deities. They both seem to be burning with religious zeal, and neither of them seem to like any competition. And they're both prepared to use lethal violence against their opponents' prophets to protect the total authority of their religious belief system and their gods. So if anything, they're just as bad as each other, in my mind at least. But Jezebel gets vilified for what she does, while Elijah is hailed as a hero.
Yeah, that's very true. When you put it like that, there does seem to be a bit of a double standard at play here.
So how does Jezebel respond when she hears that her prophets have been killed? I'm guessing she won't be very happy.
She is not. But she's not intimidated by Elijah or his God either. In 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 2, she sends a message to Elijah warning him that she's planning to kill him within the next 24 hours.
Okay, that's a very intense response. And what does Elijah do?
We're told in verse 3 that Elijah, quote, was afraid and ran for his life. He travels for a day or so and then camps out in the wilderness.
And again, that really speaks to the power and presence of Jezebel, doesn't it? She's a very unusual woman because in the Hebrew Bible, it's extremely rare for a man to admit that he's frightened of a woman. I'm not sure if I can think of any other text where that happens. And she doesn't seem to be afraid of anything or anyone, does she? She's not even scared of Israel's God, even after God's impressive pyrotechnics on the top of Mount Carmel.
No, that's right. She's absolutely fearless.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I don't condone Jezebel's violence against the Israelite prophets, not at all, but I can't help feeling a little bit in awe of her.
Yeah, and a little bit scared of her.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she terrifies me. If she ever sent me a message saying, I'm coming for you, I would be running for the hills too. So what does Jezebel do next, Em?
Well, she disappears for a few chapters, but when she comes back, she again does something that gets her into trouble.
Oh no, what does she do this time?
Well, in chapter 21, we're introduced to a man called Naboth, who owns a vineyard. And Ahab decides that he'd really rather like to turn Naboth's vineyard into a vegetable garden because it's close to the palace. So he asks Naboth if he can buy the vineyard. But Naboth says no. It's a family vineyard, the inheritance of his ancestors, and he doesn't feel he can sell it.
I'm guessing Ahab isn't too happy about that.
He is not. We're told that he, quote, went home sullen and angry, and he lay on his bed sulking and refused to eat.
Oh, gosh, what a man-child.
I know, right? Then Jezebel appears and asks him what's wrong. He tells her about the vineyard, and she replies, quote, is this how you act as king over Israel? Get up and eat. Cheer up. I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite.
I really love Jezebel's response here, the way that she simply tells Ahab to leave everything to her.
Yeah.
Yeah, so funny. It really emphasizes her confidence and her willingness to take charge, doesn't it? If something needs doing, she'll do it.
Exactly, exactly.
So what happens next?
Do you want to read out verses 8 to 10, please, Kaz?
Certainly. So Jezebel wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed his seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city with him. In those letters she wrote, proclaim a day of fasting and seat Naboth in a prominent place among the people. But seat two scoundrels opposite him and have them bring charges against him, that he has cursed both God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death. Oh, Jezebel, that is so underhand. She's really setting Naboth up, isn't she?
Yeah, she absolutely is. When the elders and nobles get her letter, they carry out her orders and poor Naboth is stoned to death. Then they send word to Jezebel to tell her Naboth is dead, and as soon as she hears the news, she tells Ahab to get up because the vineyard is now his for the taking. And Ahab does as he's told.
It's interesting, isn't it, that she writes the letters in Ahab's name and uses his royal seal, but even so, the nobles and elders seem to know the letters are from her because they tell her, not Ahab, about Naboth's death. The fact that these elders and nobles obey her really speaks to her power and authority, doesn't it? She's such a formidable character.
Yeah, she is. And in a sense, her behaviour reminds me a bit of King David.
Oh, really? In what way?
Well, if you remember from our episode on David, he orchestrated the death of Bathsheba's husband Uriah. And he did this by writing a letter to his army general, telling him to put Uriah on the front line so that he'd be killed. David and Jezebel both write royal letters to plan a murder. And in both cases, it's made clear that what they did was sinful and wrong. But while David remains a hero in the eyes of so many biblical readers, Jezebel is never really forgiven for what she does to Naboth.
I wonder if that's because her actions here are not what you'd expect from a biblical woman.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, she's exerting her authority over other men. She's being politically proactive. She's initiating violence. All behaviours we would expect of biblical men, not of biblical women. And the fact that she's judged more harshly than David actually reminds me of the way that female criminals are often viewed more negatively than their male counterparts, because they're not only breaking societal rules, they're also subverting traditional stereotypes of acceptable femininity. Now, we've mentioned this in some of our previous episodes, that violent women are viewed with a lot of suspicion because violence isn't something we associate with femininity. Women are expected to be nurturers and caregivers, not murderers. So female killers such as Aileen Wuornos, Myra Hindley, and Rosemary West are often reframed in the media as sort of monsters or demonic, deviant, and dangerous creatures who are pathologically unfeminine and who have rejected their own womanhood.
So Jezebel is doubly deviant. She's breaking the law by orchestrating Naboth's murder, and she's breaking the gender codes of acceptable femininity.
Yeah, exactly. She seems to be very at home occupying spaces we tend to associate with masculinity, such as politics, religious authority, and violence. So maybe that's partly why she's seen in such a negative light.
Yeah, that's such a good point. But it's also worth noting that she does fulfill two of the roles typically expected of biblical women. She's a wife, although, as we've seen, she seems to have her husband wrapped around her little finger, and that is a bit unusual among biblical wives. And we learn later that she's also a mother. She has two sons, Ahaziah and Joram. But motherhood doesn't seem to be a major feature of her character, because it's only mentioned once or twice in passing.
That's really interesting. But tell me, Em, what happens after Naboth's death? Does Jezebel suffer any repercussions?
Not immediately, no. But her arch nemesis Elijah soon learns about what's happened and comes to speak with Ahab.
Oh, I wonder why Elijah doesn't speak to Jezebel.
Maybe he's avoiding her, and to be honest, Kaz, at this point, I'm not sure I blame him.
No, me neither. So what does Elijah say to Ahab?
Well, he doesn't pull any punches. He tells Ahab that God is going to bring disaster on him and wipe out his descendants.
And does Elijah mention Jezebel?
Yeah, he does. In verse 23, he says, quote, "And also concerning Jezebel, the Lord says, dogs will devour Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel." And then, just to really drive it home, the narrator cuts in and says, quote, "There was never anyone like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by Jezebel, his wife."
So Ahab is being held accountable here, but at the same time, he's let off the hook a wee bit because the narrator is suggesting that he's done all these wicked things because he's been influenced by his even more wicked wife.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Now, that warning about Jezebel being devoured by dogs, it comes true, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. In 2 Kings chapter 9, a commander in the Israelite army called Jehu is anointed by an unnamed prophet to be the next king over Israel. Ahab is dead, and his son Joram is currently king. Now, Jehu goes to visit Joram. And when they meet, Joram says to him, "Have you come in peace, Jehu?" And Jehu answers, "How can there be peace as long as your mother Jezebel continues all her prostitutions and sorceries?"
Prostitutions and sorceries? What does he mean?
Yeah, so the word translated here as prostitutions comes from the Hebrew word zana, which refers to sexual immorality or prostitution. But it's often used metaphorically in the Hebrew Bible to refer to idolatry. Israelites are often accused of prostituting themselves before other gods rather than being faithful to Israel's deity. So it's likely that this is the meaning intended here. Jezebel is being accused of idolatry rather than sexual immorality. After all, she appears to have been a faithful wife to Ahab. There's nothing in the text to suggest otherwise.
And is there anything to suggest she was into sorcery?
No, there's not. As Will Gaffney rightly says, quote, "Jezebel does not use sex or sorcery to kill the Israelite prophets or take Naboth's land. She uses power and authority like any male monarch. Similarly, the charge of sorcery is bombast and may indicate how simply unacceptable it was that Jezebel, a foreign woman, was the de facto monarch of Israel."
Yeah, I think that's the main issue, isn't it? And I think Will Gaffney captures it so well. Jezebel's a woman with huge political and religious power, and that can't be tolerated in patriarchal Israel.
No, it can't. But it's interesting that even at the scene of her death in 2 Kings chapter 9, her behaviour is often interpreted as a sign of her sexual treachery. Kaz, can you read out verses 30 to 31, please?
Sure. So just for context, Jehu has murdered King Joram, the son of Ahab and Jezebel. And then he travels to Jezreel, where Jezebel is currently located. And so we read, "When Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. She painted her eyes and adorned her head and looked out of the window. As Jehu entered the gate, she said, 'Is all well, Zimri, murderer of your master?'" Okay, I have quite a few questions. First of all, why does she call Jehu Zimri?
Yeah, so I think Jezebel is taunting Jehu here. Back in 1 Kings 16, Zimri staged a coup by murdering the king and all the other claimants to the throne. But his coup wasn't very successful because Zimri only ruled for 1 week before he too was defeated.
Ah, so this is quite a clever burn by Jezebel.
Yeah, it's a nice mixture of taunt and threat. She's warning Jehu that his time as king of Israel is going to be equally short-lived. And she's also making clear to him that she's not intimidated by him.
No, not at all. Okay, so here's my second question. Why is she putting on makeup and doing her hair at this very critical moment in time?
Well, a number of scholars have suggested that she's kind of primping herself for Jehu's arrival. She's planning to seduce him or use her sexual allure to win him over to her side. And certainly the image of a woman donning makeup is used in a few biblical texts to imply sexual seduction. But other scholars disagree and argue that she's more interested in asserting her political power here than sexually seducing Jehu. The way she taunts him, I think, makes that really clear.
Yeah, I agree. But the idea that Jezebel's preparing to seduce Jehu actually reminds me of the way some contemporary criminal women are also sexualized, or their power and criminality are understood as being connected to their dangerous sexuality.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. Have you heard of Bernardine Dorn?
No, I don't think so. Who is she?
She was a leader in the far-left Marxist militant group called the Weather Underground, which was active in the United States between 1969 and 1977. Now, the FBI identified the Weather Underground as a domestic terrorist group after members took part in various bomb attacks and riots intended to overthrow the US government. Now, I was reading something recently by political scientist Laura Schoberg, and she said that Bernardine Dorn has often been described as a woman who used her sexuality to retain her place as a leader in this group. Laura Schoberg quotes another scholar who essentially accused Bernardine of controlling the men in the group, quote, "by keeping her blouse unbuttoned and breasts exposed during strategy meetings." Okay, so that's something I should keep in mind for my future strategy meetings.
Yeah, it's not the kind of tip I was expecting us to give out on this podcast, but here we are.
Yeah, here we are. But as Laura Schoberg says, that in relation to this accusation against Bernardine, you know, when we sexualize Bernardine in this way, it only downplays her real motivations for being involved in the Wither Underground movement, you know, such as her political convictions and her ideologies. And it also really undermines any real leadership skills that she actually had. So if we take that back to Jezebel, I wonder if something similar is going on here when scholars interpret her beautifying herself as evidence that she planned to seduce Jehu, because that effectively implies that Jezebel's impressive, like highly impressive political and religious power is driven solely by her dangerous sexuality. And her political acumen and her religious convictions are ignored in favour of painting her quite literally as a treacherously sexualized woman.
Yeah, that's such an important point. And the sexualization of Bernardine Dawn also reminds me of Patty Hearst, who we mentioned in our episode on Eve. Wasn't Hearst also accused of seducing members of the terrorist group she belonged to, the Symbionese Liberation Army, to ensure that they accepted her?
Yeah, that's right. There was a very similar process going on there too. But I'm also struck by the fact that this is the first time in the narrative we see Jezebel doing something that's strongly associated with femininity.
Why do you think that's important?
Well, we've already talked about the way that she subverts gender stereotypes. Up to now, she seemed very comfortable occupying the masculine spaces of power and authority. But just before her death, she's presented to the audience as unambiguously feminine through her act of donning makeup and fixing her hair. And it makes me wonder if this is a deliberate reminder that women's attempts to subvert gender norms can never be tolerated. They can never last. She's a woman whose greatest crime was succeeding in a man's world. So she has to go.
So in other words, the narrator is focusing on Jezebel's feminine identity here because that's the real problem. She's a woman with power, and for that reason, she has to be destroyed.
Yeah, exactly.
That reminds me of what biblical scholar Judith McKinley says about this verse. She says, quote, "The writer wants us to understand that while this is indeed a woman in all the feminine senses, this is one who has not acted her part as a woman in Israel. And women who do not behave like women, according to this narrator's gender construction, must fall from their place. Crossing boundaries, including gender boundaries, has fateful, even deathly consequences. Such people must be removed for the health and well-being of the greater good."
Ah, yeah, that's such a good point. And it could very well be what's going on here. Okay, so I have a final question before we move on. Is there any significance to Jezebel sitting at the window when Jehu arrives?
So some biblical scholars suggest that her placement at the window might be a reference to ancient Southwest Asian images of goddesses such as Asherah sitting at windows.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. And this association between Jezebel and goddesses might be significant when we consider what happens next. So can you read out verses 32 to 33 for us, please, Kaz?
Certainly. Jehu looked up to the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" Two or three eunuchs looked out at him. He said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down. Some of her blood splattered on the wall and on the horses, who trampled on her. Oh, that's such a horrible ending for Jezebel, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's so brutal and so public. And there's no legal due process, no trial, no conviction. Jehu just takes matters into his own hand and murders her. It's really shocking, and I find it really disturbing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And if we think back to what I just said about women at the window imagery being associated with goddesses, I wonder if Jezebel's death marks the destruction of her femininity and the destruction of goddess worship. In other words, Jezebel's death is also the symbolic death of the goddesses she worships and represents.
Ah, yeah. So in essence, female political power and female religious power can't be tolerated.
Exactly.
It's as though both of these things are, air quotes, foreign to Israel, just as Jezebel was herself foreign and is depicted as totally other. So what happens next, Em?
Well, we're told that after Jezebel's murder, Jehu goes into the house and has something to eat.
Oh, that just feels so heartless.
Yeah, right? He's literally dining on his success. But then he seems to have a change of heart. Let me read out verses 35 to 37. Jehu says, "See to that cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter." But when they went to bury her, they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. When they came back and told him, he said, "This is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Elijah the Tishbite. In the territory of Jezreel, the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel. The corpse of Jezebel shall be like dung on the field in the territory of Jezreel, so that no one can say, 'This is Jezebel.'"
So Jezebel's body has clearly been left where it fell, and dogs have eaten it, all but for a few bones and body parts. It's just so chilling.
Yeah.
And it really emphasizes Jezebel's utter destruction, doesn't it? She's been trampled, broken apart, and consumed, then reduced to excrement. I can't think of any other death in the Bible that's so contemptuous of the victim.
No, me neither. And the way Jehu speaks about her after her death is equally chilling. He calls her "that cursed woman" rather than using her name. And he refers to her as a king's daughter rather than admitting that she was Israel's queen. So he's erasing her status and power. It's not enough to simply kill her. She must be utterly destroyed and removed from the community. He doesn't even want anyone uttering her name.
Do you know if there's any significance to the body parts that were left, particularly her feet and the palms of her hand? Why do you think they were mentioned specifically?
Well, biblical scholars have come up with a few suggestions. Judith McKinley points out that the Hebrew words for hands and feet are sometimes used as euphemisms for genitals, so maybe Jezebel is once again being associated with her sexuality.
That's really disturbing. It feels as though she's being exposed sexually, even after her death.
Yeah, it's really disturbing. Another theory put forward by biblical scholar Jennifer Hoost is that it might be a reference to Canaanite goddess Anat, who, according to Canaanite mythology, wore a necklace and belt made out of human skulls and hands. So this detail may be a way of mocking Jezebel for her faithfulness to these religious traditions. But however we interpret it, I think the aim here is to denigrate Jezebel even further and to emphasize her complete destruction.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So that marks the end of Jezebel's story in the Hebrew Bible. But if you've listened to our episode on New Testament violence from season one of the podcast, you'll know that a female figure called Jezebel is mentioned in the book of Revelation chapter 2. Now, we don't have time today to talk about that in any great detail, but I thought it was worth mentioning. What can you remember about Jezebel in Revelation, Kaz?
So if I recall, Jezebel was the name given to a female prophet in the church at Thyatira. And she was accused of false teachings, which encouraged church members to engage in sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I thought it was worth bringing up here because it seems to me that this woman in Revelation is being othered in the same way that Queen Jezebel was othered. Like Queen Jezebel, the Jezebel of Revelation is accused of leading people astray from the true faith.
Why do you think John, the author of Revelation, chose to call this female prophet Jezebel?
Well, according to New Testament scholar Robin Whittaker, this female leader in Thyatira is being presented, like Queen Jezebel, as a threat to masculine religious power. What's more, John effectively undermines her reputation and religious authority by associating her with the much maligned Jezebel of 1 and 2 Kings.
Yeah, and by calling her Jezebel, you could also say that John is framing her as a dangerous threat to her community.
Exactly. You might also remember that the Jezebel in Revelation is threatened with horrific punishment. In verses 22 to 23, Christ himself is described as warning that he will, quote, "throw her on a bed and strike her children dead." We discussed in our previous episode how the allusion to throwing her on a bed has connotations of sexual violence. What strikes me here is the way that both Jezebels are being thrown down by men and their bodies brutalized as a punishment for the threat they pose to the religious status quo. And in both cases, there seems to be divine approval. Queen Jezebel's murderer is Jehu, the Lord's anointed, and her gruesome death is foretold by the highly esteemed Elijah, the prophet. With the prophetess in Revelation, it's Christ himself who denounces her and declares her punishment. These women's brutal assaults are reframed as divine victory of good over evil, and that's just so problematic.
Yeah, it really, really is. It's so misogynistic. The brutality enacted by men against these women's bodies is celebrated in both texts, isn't it?
Mm.
And I wonder if it's meant to serve as a warning to women to effectively stay in their lane. It's saying to women, don't try to exert your own authority. Don't try to be powerful. Don't trespass on masculine spaces of politics and religion because you don't belong there. You're not welcome and you'll be punished if you try.
Yeah, I also wonder if the allusions to Jezebel's sexuality in 2 Kings chapter 9 and Revelation chapter 2 explain why the name Jezebel has become a very common term, even today, to malign certain women as being sexually immoral. If you call someone a Jezebel, you're not giving them a compliment, right?
No.
You're effectively accusing them of being a treacherous sexual temptress. Even if you look up the word Jezebel in a dictionary, the definition given often captures this meaning. So, for example, the Merriam-Webster dictionary defines a Jezebel as, quote, an impudent, shameless, or morally unrestrained woman.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I've also heard the name Jezebel being used as a trope or stereotype to malign women of colour. Have you heard of that use, Em?
Yeah, I have, but say a little bit more about it.
So the Jezebel trope appears to have developed in the United States around the 18th century or maybe even a bit earlier. And it was originally used to accuse African and African-American enslaved women of being seductive, predatory, and sexually insatiable. In contrast, white women were considered to be pure, chaste, and modest. According to an article I read by David Pilgrim, and I'm quoting him here, white slave owners regularly justified their sexual abuse of enslaved women by insisting that black women were Jezebels, that is, naturally more promiscuous and tempting than white women. Now, this Jezebel stereotype may be centuries old, but it's still very much present in contemporary culture, where we often see hyper-sexualized images of black women in advertising, music videos, video games, and films. And as Pilgrim also mentions, this stereotype continues to have a really negative impact on black women's sense of self and their vulnerability to rape and intimate partner violence.
Yeah, it's such a damaging stereotype.
It really is, yeah.
I also think that the otherness of these two biblical Jezebels is captured in another contemporary use of Jezebel's name. Have you heard of the Jezebel spirit, Kaz?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so. What's it about?
It's a phrase that started getting used in some Pentecostal and charismatic evangelical discourses, particularly those coming out of the US. And it grew out of a conflation of the Jezebels we find in 1 and 2 Kings and in Revelation chapter 2. According to scholar Jonathan O'Donnell, the Jezebel spirit is understood to be a dangerous spiritual or demonic force that makes people tolerant of identities and lifestyles deemed dangerous and ungodly in the conservative evangelical imagination. So queer identities and sexualities, other than white bodies, reproductive rights, feminism, religious pluralism, and multiculturalism. In other words, the Jezebel spirit is understood to threaten everything that's held as sacrosanct in conservative politics and religion.
Oh, that's absolutely fascinating. And is this Jezebel spirit found only in women, or can it affect people of any gender?
It's used in reference to anyone, but it does seem to be applied to women in particular. Melissa Archer says that the Jezebel spirit is often associated with women who are considered to be controlling, manipulative, and above all, seductive. Women possessed by the Jezebel spirit are women who don't obey their husbands, who want some authority and control, or who wish to be pastors or leaders in their church.
Ah, so in other words, women are deemed to have this Jezebel spirit if they refuse to be passive and subordinate, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Archer also comments that this connection between Jezebel, the female figure, and the demonic forces of evil has led to violent and misogynistic language being used in church contexts to describe how the spirit must be destroyed.
That's really, really disturbing. It seems to me that the name Jezebel has been weaponized as a way to demonize women and anyone else who doesn't conform to white, conservative, patriarchal values. And it's such a horribly effective weapon because it allows you to frame anything or anyone you disapprove of as dangerous and godless.
Yeah. This notion of the Jezebel spirit and also the Jezebel stereotype used against women of colour are profoundly problematic because they equate femininity and non-whiteness with danger and threat. They seem to condone misogyny and demonise women's power and agency. It's so infuriating.
Yeah, it really, really is.
So, Kaz, I hope you've found this episode on Jezebel as interesting as I have.
I definitely have. It's been equal parts fascinating, shocking, enraging, and also a wee bit depressing too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But shall we end the episode by telling people what we've been listening to or reading this week?
Sure. I've been listening to an excellent true crime podcast called Black Girl Gone, hosted by Amara Kofer. The podcast focuses specifically on cases where Black women and girls have been disappeared or murdered. And these are cases that don't always get a lot of media coverage, or they're not widely discussed on other true crime podcasts. Amara is a brilliant presenter, and she always centres the victim in her narrative. She also highlights the structural issues that sustain the high rates of violence against Black women and girls. And as she says on the podcast website, I'm quoting, "Our goal is to inspire action and change and to ensure that the voices of Black women who have been silenced by violence are never forgotten." So yeah, I would highly recommend it.
Thanks. I've not heard of that podcast, but it's going straight on my list. Okay, so in a couple of episodes in this series, we've mentioned womanist biblical interpretation, and we've drawn on the scholarship of womanist biblical scholars like Will Gaffney. So I'd really like to plug a podcast called Beyond the Womanist Classroom, hosted by Dr. Mitzi Smith. It's an absolutely fabulous podcast, which discusses all things womanism, biblical interpretation, and justice, and features some really brilliant interviews with other womanist scholars as well. It's so, so good.
Oh, it sounds good. Yeah, I will definitely be checking that out. Okay, so thank you for listening to this episode of The Bloody Bible. As usual, the resources we used are listed in our show notes, which you'll find on our website, along with the links to our social media accounts.
But until next time, we'll sign off and say goodbye. Stay safe, everyone.
Bye.
The Bloody Bible podcast is supported by funding from the United Kingdom Arts and Humanities Research Council as part of the Shiloh Project Research Grant. Special thanks to Professor Johanna Stiebert at the University of Leeds, who commissioned us to create the podcast and supported us into the second season. The podcast is produced by Carolyn Blythe, Emily Colgan, and myself, Richard Bonifant, who also recorded and edited each episode, whilst apologising profusely on behalf of all men. Our music is Stalker by Alexis Ortiz Sofield, courtesy of Pixabay Music, and the podcast artwork was created by Sarah Lee West. Our social media links are found in the notes to this episode. Please leave us a 5-star review. Thanks for listening.